Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
I'm so excited to tell you JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited-time men's collection for the everyday guy. What I love about Walker Hayes is his laid-back nature. He's a family man and being a country megastar while also having seven kids. You know he likes to keep his style cool and casual. This new collection is perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear, affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th. Just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
You're listening to History on Trial, a production of iHeart Podcasts. Listener discretion advised.
On the evening of November 5th, 1954, Florence Kautz got ready for bed as usual. A 37-year-old secretary living on quiet Waring Avenue in West Hollywood, Los Angeles, Kautz put her curlers in, slipped under the covers, and turned off the lights. It was a Friday, so maybe she even planned to sleep in the next day. But she wouldn't get the chance. In the middle of the night, Florence's door exploded inward in a shower of wood and glass. Before she could react, a group of men rushed in. A blinding light flashed in her face. Florence huddled in her bed, paralyzed by fear. And then, nothing. She heard one of the men yell, "We've got the wrong place." They turned around and ran out through her kitchen, breaking glasses and leaving a mess. Once she was certain they were gone, Florence called the police, who couldn't make heads or tails of the event. "It must have been an attempted burglary," an officer told the terrified woman. She was lucky to have escaped unhurt. And because she hadn't seen any of the men's faces, blinded by the bright lights they'd shown, there wasn't much for the police to go on. The case wasn't likely to get solved, Florence learned. She would just have to live with the fear. But less than a year later, a shocking break in the case arrived from an unusual source, a tabloid magazine. In September 1955, Confidential magazine, the top celebrity scandal sheet in the country, published a story about the break-in at Florence Kautz's apartment. It might seem like a strange story for a celebrity magazine to care about, but Confidential had good reason. The men who had broken into Florence's apartment that night, the article claimed, were none other than Frank Sinatra and Joe DiMaggio. In the article, titled "The Real Reason for Marilyn Monroe's Divorce," Confidential explained how the famous singer and the Yankees star had come to be there. Florence Kautz, it turned out, lived in the same small apartment building as one of Marilyn Monroe's friends, an actress named Sheila Stewart. Joe DiMaggio, still reeling from his and Monroe's divorce, had become convinced that Monroe was using Stewart's apartment to meet with the man he thought Monroe had left him for. Acting on information from the private investigator he'd hired, and likely fueled by more than a few drinks, DiMaggio had enlisted some friends, including Sinatra, to help him catch Monroe in the act. It was a sloppy plan, and it had unsurprisingly gone very wrong. Instead of going into Sheila Stewart's apartment on the second floor, the group had broken into the first floor home of Florence Kotz. So Florence finally got some answers about what had happened to her that night. And she eventually got some reparations. She sued DiMaggio, Sinatra, and the other men, and got a settlement. But the story of the wrong door raid, as it came to be known, was far from over. Because California officials had some questions about how Confidential magazine had gotten their story. In February 1957, California State Senator Fred Kraft held a series of hearings to determine if Confidential had gotten the story by paying off a private investigator. You might be wondering, why would a state legislature care where a scandal magazine got its stories from? Well, Confidential magazine wasn't just any scandal magazine. It was one of the most powerful publications in the country, with a reader base in the millions and the ability to ruin a star's career with a few carefully worded sentences. People all across America worried that Confidential's salacious content would corrupt the country's youth. In California, politicians and entertainment executives worried that its shocking stories would destroy the lucrative movie industry. And so by 1957, the studios and the government were looking for ways to take the magazine down. The state Senate hearings into the wrong door raid story were only the first step. 3 months later, in May 1957, a grand jury convened by the ambitious California Attorney General Pat Brown indicted Confidential, along with several key employees and partner businesses, on, among other things, charges of conspiracy to commit criminal libel and conspiracy to publish obscene and indecent material. For years, Confidential had held Hollywood hostage, using a network of informants to dig up dirt on America's biggest celebrities. But now Hollywood was fighting back with the assistance of the government. The ensuing trial would put the right of freedom of the press into question, because Confidential stories were nasty, no doubt. But, the magazine would claim, they were all true. And could publishing the truth, no matter how indecent, ever be a crime? Americans were about to find out. Welcome to History on Trial. I'm your host, Mira Hayward. This week, the state of California v. Confidential. Confidential's creator and publisher, Robert Harrison, was no stranger to scandal. After coming up as a reporter for the New York Gossip Rags, Harrison had gone into business for himself, creating a number of so-called girly magazines, publications filled with images of scantily clad women. Harrison was a hands-on magazine executive, regularly acting as a photographer for his magazines, and sometimes even posing in photos himself. He was also an ambitious man. When his girly magazines failed to make ends meet, Harrison began casting around for a new, more profitable concept, and he found it on television. Throughout 1950 and 1951, a Senate committee led by Senator Estes Kefauver investigated the state of organized crime in America in a series of hearings that were broadcast live on television. Americans were glued to their TV screens as a procession of mobsters testified in front of the committee. The March 1951 hearing in New York attracted an estimated 30 million viewers. Harrison was also inspired by the Confidential series of books, which came out between 1948 and 1952 and profiled different American cities: New York Confidential, Chicago Confidential, and so on. The Confidential series claimed to reveal what was really happening in these cities. The books shocked their readers with depictions of crime, sex, and debauchery happening, allegedly, in the heart of every city. They had a distinct point of view. As historian and law professor Samantha Barbas puts it in her book on the magazine, Confidential, Confidential, the Confidential books were racist, sexist, homophobic, and largely false. They were also bestsellers. Seeing the public interest in the Kefauver hearings and the Confidential books, Harrison had a realization. The American people craved this kind of content. The story behind the story, a glimpse into the private lives of public figures and the dirty underbelly of modern life. Thus, Confidential magazine was born. The first issue of Confidential, which hit newsstands in September 1952, set the tone for what was to come. The cover, printed in lurid, eye-catching blue, yellow, and red, featured giant headlines that leapt from the page. Photographs were grainy, blown up, and unflattering. And like that of its namesake book series, the magazine's content was sleazy, shocking, and bigoted. This type of magazine, focused on exposés and gossip, were often called scandal magazines. Confidential wasn't the only scandal magazine on the market, so Robert Harrison had to find a way to set it apart. Plan A? Lie. If his reporters couldn't find juicy enough stories, they could just make up better ones. Early issues of Confidential featured completely invented tales of sex and crime, bolstered up by posed or composite photos. But even bonkers creations like a mob-run grave-robbing ring couldn't boost the magazine's circulation. Harrison needed a new angle. In the summer of 1953, he found it. In the August issue, Confidential ran an article about the relationship between Joe DiMaggio and Marilyn Monroe, who were then dating. The piece, called Why Joe DiMaggio is Striking Out with Marilyn Monroe, alleged that Monroe's mentor, the 76-year-old co-founder of 20th Century Fox, Joe Schenck, was interfering in the relationship, either out of concern for Monroe's career or because Schenck was sleeping with Monroe himself. The magazine heavily implied it was the latter, and Americans ate it up. Confidential's circulation doubled overnight. Harrison knew he was onto something. If people liked reading about the secret lives of mobsters, they loved reading about the secret lives of movie stars. Throughout the rest of 1953 and 1954, Confidential increasingly focused its coverage on Hollywood. We've got to have more Hollywood stories, Harrison told his staff. The hotter, the better. A decade earlier, it would have been impossible for a magazine like Confidential to get the kind of Hollywood stories they wanted. For the first half of the 20th century, Hollywood had been tightly managed by the movie studios. Studios controlled every step of the film business, from production to distribution, and they controlled the lives and images of their contracted stars with the same iron fist. The only way for journalists to get access to stars was to play along with the studios and produce the kind of positive coverage they wanted. But by the 1950s, the studio system was crumbling. A 1948 Supreme Court decision, United States v. Paramount Pictures, Inc., had ruled that the studios held an unfair monopoly. Studios were forced to give up control over many aspects of the business, dealing them a serious financial blow. At the same time, the rise of television had decreased movie attendance. As the studios lost power, their threats to blackball journalists who didn't cover stars in the right way lost weight. And the stars, who were used to the studios covering up their bad behavior, were suddenly very exposed. The gossip cup was running over, and Confidential was ready to catch every last drop. Harrison began coordinating a network of informants across Los Angeles. Everyone from sex workers to police officers to studio employees, and even movie stars themselves, soon learned that Confidential would pay well for good dirt. Confidential paid nannies to spy on employers, hairdressers to listen in on client conversations, and waiters to remember who ate with whom. To get their stories, Confidential equipped its sources with all sorts of spy gadgets, including bugs to tap phone lines and watches that held hidden recorders. Harrison's niece, Marjorie Mead, and her husband, Fred, eventually moved to Los Angeles and established a company called Hollywood Research Inc., which coordinated and organized the information coming in from tipsters. Harrison had correctly gauged the public's interest in Hollywood gossip. By 1955, the magazine's circulation was close to 4 million. Most copies were passed along to additional readers, an estimated 4 readers per copy, putting Confidential's readership at close to 16 million people, or one in every 10 Americans. With that kind of audience came great power. Confidential's stories could make or break a star's career. A March 1955 story about an alleged interracial romance between the white actress Ava Gardner and the black singer-dancer Sammy Davis Jr. led to Gardner's films being boycotted and banned in parts of the country. 2 months later, a story about the actor Rory Calhoun's criminal past and how he had turned his life around thanks to religion earned Calhoun 8,000 fan letters and completely revitalized his career. As Confidential's influence grew, the movie studios increasingly came to view the magazine as a threat. The studios were more vulnerable than ever. Their profits were down, and their audiences were straying. People also thought Hollywood was corrupting the country's morals. The studios even faced a Senate inquiry into whether movies could be tied to a rise in juvenile delinquency. The last thing Hollywood needed was a magazine digging up all of the industry's buried bodies. In the mid-1950s, the studios decided to fight back, and they were prepared to fight dirty. In the summer of 1955, studio publicity heads met in secret at the Beverly Hills Hotel to discuss the Confidential problem. Shortly after the meeting, one of the publicists traveled to New York to meet with Confidential's editors. "Wouldn't it be better for everyone," he asked the editors, "if the magazine focused on athletes or politicians or really anyone besides Hollywood stars?" Confidential's editors laughed him out of the office. This straightforward approach having failed, the publicists moved on to something more cloak and dagger. Enlisting movie producers and an actress to help them, the publicists cooked up an elaborate trap for Confidential. The team planted gossip about the actress, backing up their story with witnesses. They made sure the story eventually got to Confidential via a chain of tipsters. When Confidential sent a private investigator to look into the story, everything seemed to check out. But had Confidential run it, they would have been vulnerable to an enormous libel suit, because the story the publicists had planted was entirely verifiably false. At the last minute, though, the magazine had doubts and killed the story. The studios were foiled again. If they couldn't control Confidential, the studios decided, maybe they could control the flow of information out of Hollywood. Each of the 6 largest studios agreed to contribute to a fund which would pay for a private security force to monitor stars' behaviors and interfere with Confidential's information gathering network. But the studios eventually balked, fearing that Confidential would discover their plans and attack. A plan to blacklist anyone thought to be a Confidential informant was abandoned for similar reasons. Celebrities, sick of having their dirty laundry aired in the magazine's pages, wanted the studios to fight harder. Many stars felt powerless on their own. They had the option to file libel suits against Confidential, yes, but there were a number of reasons not to. First, a suit could draw attention to the very thing that the stars hoped to keep hidden.
"Filing a suit would only give Confidential the publicity they want," said Marlon Brando. "And maybe I'd get an award of 8 cents. There was also the fear that a suit would provoke Confidential into spilling even more information about the star. It was well known that Confidential often published only parts of the stories they received from tipsters, holding on to the most damaging tidbits as insurance against legal action. And finally, there was the problem of jurisdiction. Confidential was a New York-based company. Most of the stars it wrote about lived in California and filed their rare libel suits against the magazine in that state, suits that judges quickly dismissed, saying that California did not have jurisdiction over a New York company. The New York courts were notoriously backed up, and filing there might have meant a years-long wait to be heard. As stars considered how best to deal with Confidential, the studios escalated their battle to the federal level. In August 1955, several studio heads reached out to Postmaster General Arthur Summerfield with a bold request. They wanted the post office to revoke Confidential's mailing privileges. One movie producer was alleged to have told Summerfield, "Unless they take away Harrison's mailing privileges, this industry is done for." Summerfield, who saw obscenity as one of the gravest threats to American society, had his own reasons for disliking Confidential. On August 27th, he issued a withhold from dispatch order on the November issue of Confidential. Under the order's terms, no issue of Confidential could be mailed without first being reviewed by the post office and being found free of improper content. The determination of whether content was or was not improper was entirely up to the post office. Harrison responded by filing suit against Summerfield, and a judge eventually ruled in the magazine's favor, saying that the post office was violating the magazine's right to due process by threatening to ban it with no notices, charges, or hearings. Confidential had won again. The fight with the post office had even raised the magazine's profile, and with that, its circulation. But a raised profile also brought unwanted scrutiny. The studio executives were not alone in their concerns about Confidential. Segments of the American public were worried about the effect scandal magazines might have on the nation's morals. To some, these magazines seemed to represent everything wrong with the country. As one Californian told a newspaper, quote, "All scandal magazines should be taken off the market. They are a menace to society. They carry nothing but trash, and that is no good for our youth." Scandal magazines weren't the only target for criticism. Many Americans worried about the effect of any reading materials that freely discussed hot-button topics like sex, violence, and race. Throughout the 1950s, many communities set up review boards, which determined if publications were inappropriate. If they were found to be so, local distributors, including booksellers, newsstands, and libraries, were strongly encouraged not to carry these items, under the vague threat of legal action. What about freedom of the press, you might ask? Here's one magazine writing on that very question in 1957. Quote, "The framers of the Constitution never meant the First Amendment to protect filth peddlers who poison minds." And this magazine wasn't the only one to take this position. Many journalists and publications believed that scandal magazines like Confidential were not entitled to the same legal protections as more traditional publications. They feared that aligning themselves with scandal magazines could end up damaging their own rights. Back in Hollywood, the studios sensed that the tide of public opinion might be turning their way. In October 1956, when Harrison appeared on The Tonight Show to defend scandal magazines, the audience booed him. It was time for the studios to strike. In December 1956, MGM released Slander, a movie about an unscrupulous scandal magazine publisher unfairly ruining the life of a well-meaning actor. The movie was melodramatic. It ends with the publisher's mother killing him, disgusted by what her son has become, and flopped at the box office. But its heavy-handed message did not go unnoticed. Slander, quote, "reeks with the motion picture industry's long pent-up sense of vengeance," wrote Texas's Amarillo Globe. Harrison responded in a typically cheeky fashion, hiring models to picket the movie outside a Broadway theater, holding signs that read, "Slander is unfair to Confidential." But the studios weren't done there.
though their attempt to get confidential through the post office had failed, they now recognized the power of governmental attacks on the magazine. In January 1957, the California State Senate formed a committee to investigate the practices of private detectives in the state. Or at least, that was the committee's alleged purpose. In reality, the committee had been formed at the behest of the studios and planned to look into how Confidential got its stories.
This was the committee mentioned in the prologue that looked into the wrong door raid at Florence Kotze's apartment.
The committee's investigation eventually fizzled out in March, with lead Senator Fred Kraft declaring that though the magazines were a, quote, national disgrace, the field is beyond the scope of a single state legislature. But the state's war on Confidential was far from over. California Attorney General Pat Brown announced that his office, in tandem with the Los Angeles County District Attorney, would now be pursuing charges against Confidential. Brown said his decision was motivated by a desire to protect children from the magazine. He also claimed that Confidential, quote, caused divorces and broken homes and led to blackmail. But behind the scenes, the studios were again pulling the strings. Brown was pursuing a run for governor, and the film industry had made it clear to him that they would look favorably upon a candidate who supported their crusade against Confidential. In May 1957, Brown and Los Angeles County District Attorney William McKesson convened a grand jury to look into Confidential. On May 15th, the grand jury indicted Confidential, members of its staff, its printer and distributor, and its sister magazine, Whisper, on four charges, including conspiracy to commit criminal libel and conspiracy to publish obscene and indecent material. Robert Harrison addressed the charges directly in an editorial in Confidential. "This magazine is under assault in the California courts," Harrison wrote. "This is a determined effort initiated by a segment of the motion picture industry to get this magazine."
He positioned Confidential as a brave truth teller, a publication unafraid to reveal to the American people what the elite did not want them to know. Is an American jury going to get us for daring to tell that truth? Harrison asked. We don't believe so. His assumptions would soon be put to the test. Confidential's trial was scheduled to begin in August.
It almost ended before it started, though, because it seemed that both sides had lost their appetite for the fight. Throughout the summer, Harrison's lawyers had been issuing subpoenas for celebrities. Most stars had managed to avoid the summons, slipping out of back entrances, heading to Las Vegas, even leaving the country. But some hadn't. Dean Martin, Lana Turner, and Gary Cooper were among those who had received subpoenas. Studio executives panicked. The last thing they wanted was for their biggest box office draws to have to confirm or deny their sins under oath. Arthur Crowley, the high-powered Los Angeles lawyer running the defense, knew just what he was doing. "I want to make it clear that the reputations of many persons will suffer if this case goes to trial, because we are going to offer the truth as a defense," he stated. Studio executives heard Crowley's message loud and clear, and they started to have second thoughts about the trial. George Murphy, head of the Motion Picture Industry Council, approached the prosecutors and urged them to reach a compromise. The defense was receptive. Harrison knew that this trial, no matter the outcome, would be enormously expensive. So the two sides came to an agreement. Confidential would stop focusing on celebrities in exchange for some of the charges being decided by a judge and others being dropped. But Judge Herbert Walker rejected the deal. "The state had brought charges for good reason," he said, "and this compromise didn't do enough to address those charges." The trial would proceed. Stars and Confidential executives alike held their breath.
No matter who won the case, everyone knew, scandal was sure to ensue.
On August 2nd, 1957, the trial began at the Los Angeles Superior Court. Robert Harrison wasn't there. In fact, only two of the people charged in the grand jury indictment were present. All summer, Confidential's lawyers had been battling to prevent the extradition of their clients from New York, and they had succeeded. The face of Confidential at the defense table would not be its infamous publisher, Harrison, but his niece, Marjorie Mead, and her husband, Fred. Marjorie and Fred had flown back into Los Angeles in May to surrender, and Marjorie, decked out in furs and diamonds, had asked reporters then, "Don't you think this whole thing has a little to do with destruction of freedom of the press?" Now she sat quietly in the courtroom, her dyed red curls and large eyes drawing admiring looks. The prosecutors, William Ritzy and Clarence Lynn, presented quite a contrast to the glamorous Meads. Ritzy, a Los Angeles deputy district attorney, and Lynn, an assistant attorney general, were both serious, religious men. Lynn taught Sunday school back home in San Francisco, and they weren't letting the spotlight dazzle them. Though the trial had largely come about due to political pressure, Ritzy and Lynn were confident that the law was on their side. One of their first jobs was making the connection between the Meads and Confidential clear, given that the Meads were the only defendants present. That connection came, the prosecutors claimed, through a company called Hollywood Research. This was the Los Angeles business that organized and followed up on informants' tips and sent them back to Confidential. The magazine had long claimed that Hollywood Research was a completely independent organization. This was part of their strategy of claiming to have no corporate presence in California, thus making it harder for stars to sue them. But the prosecution thought otherwise, and they had good reason to think so, because Hollywood Research had been run by none other than Marjorie Mead. The prosecution took several steps during their case to prove their point, submitting phone records that showed a huge volume of calls between the Confidential office and the Hollywood Research Inc. office. They also brought out a witness, Paul Gregory, who claimed that Marjorie Mead had extorted him over keeping a story out of Confidential. Gregory's testimony had provided a dramatic moment. As he testified about Marjorie, she began to sob. And once the jury left the room, she collapsed entirely. Furious, her husband Fred had stalked over to the prosecution table and, slamming his fist down, yelled at Prosecutor Ritzy, "You must want to win this case pretty bad by putting that lying character on the stand." Ritzy was unfazed. The defense would later provide records proving that Mead could not have been with Gregory when he claimed she had.
The biggest scores for the prosecution's argument about the California Confidential connection actually came during Fred Mead's own testimony. He revealed that Harrison had been the one to suggest that he and Marjorie get into the gossip business. Harrison had even given them money to get started.
On cross, Ritzy got Mead to admit that Marjorie's brother was the company's vice president, and that the supposedly independent Hollywood Research had only ever sold information to two magazines, Confidential and its sister magazine, Whisper. Whatever the exact nature of the relationship between Hollywood Research and Confidential, and in truth, prosecutors were right. Hollywood Research had been set up by the magazine. It was clear from the testimony that the Meads were involved in this business up to their necks. And in the course of this business, the Meads and the rest of the Confidential crew, the prosecutors claimed, had conspired to commit obscenity and libel. The prosecutors now set out to prove these charges.
First up, the question of obscenity. What is obscene material? That's a hard question to answer, a question that even the law struggles with, because what makes something obscene is often subjective. In California law at the time, material was obscene if, quote, it has a substantial tendency to deprave or corrupt its readers by inciting lascivious thoughts or arousing lustful desire. In other words, if it turned people on. The magazine had been charged with not just the publication of obscene material, but also the conspiracy to publish it, meaning that two or more people had arranged, knowingly, to commit the crime.
So now Ritzy and Lynn had to prove not only that Confidential had published obscene material, but also that they had knowingly done so. The prosecution argued that Confidential had done just that. They brought Ronnie Quillen, a sex worker and frequent Confidential tipster, to the stand. Quillen testified that Harrison had wanted stories, quote, primarily dealing with the sexual activities of celebrities, and that he'd made it clear that, quote, the more lewd and lascivious the story, the more colorful the magazine. But the defense rebutted that notion, claiming that the magazine had always been careful not to cross the line into obscenity. And how had they defined that line? Daniel Ross, one of the magazine's lawyers, explained that he and Robert Harrison had compared the magazine to other published material. To prove Ross's point, Crowley, the defense attorney, submitted into evidence a whole stack of books, which Ross claimed to have used to learn what the public found acceptable in terms of obscenity. The stack included bestsellers like John Steinbeck's East of Eden and Grace Matalius's Peyton Place. Whether or not these books made sense as benchmarks for obscenity, and more importantly, whether or not Confidential had ended up publishing obscene content despite these precautions, would be up for the jury to decide. The next charge was libel. The state had again gone with a conspiracy charge, so they would have to prove two things: that the magazine had published defamatory material, and that it had done so with intent. Because the magazine was charged not with civil libel, but with criminal libel, a little-used charge that basically doesn't exist today, the burden of proving whether or not the stories were true fell to the magazine. Prosecutor Clarence Lynn had said, when the charges were announced, that he didn't think the magazine would be able to prove that their stories were true. Like many people, he seemed to assume that Confidential was sloppy in their standards, publishing anything, no matter how questionable, as long as it sounded good. But in that assumption, Lynn was very wrong. Though Confidential had started out by publishing made-up stories, once they graduated into the world of Hollywood gossip, Robert Harrison had wanted to make sure that Confidential was legally safeguarded. When the magazine decided to move forward with a tip, private investigators were hired to double-check the information. We have to have the exact time, exact date, everything documented just in case, Harrison said. Then the magazine's lawyers would prepare affidavits for their sources to sign, which read, quote, I swear that all the events described in the above story are true and that I was a participant in these events. Based on these affidavits, Confidential's writers would then put together a piece. But the legal review wasn't over yet. Lawyers would now check over every word of a story, often demanding rewrites or deletions. Their oversight was so intensive, one reporter said, that he once requested a disclaimer that an article was an attorney's work, not his own. Writers quickly learned that the best approach was to imply conclusions, not state them outright, in order to protect themselves from liability. Confidential, the testimony suggested, was very, very careful with the truth. But two of the trial's most eye-catching witnesses would reveal that Confidential's fact-checking process was not infallible. Hollywood's fears about stars being called by the defense hadn't materialized. Defense lawyer Arthur Crowley didn't want to risk being bound by the testimony of witnesses who might perjure themselves to protect their reputations. However, there were some stars who wanted to testify. Their names were Maureen O'Hara and Dorothy Dandridge. O'Hara, an actress, came to court to respond to a March 1957 article titled, quote, It was the hottest show in town when Maureen O'Hara cuddled in row 35. The article alleged that O'Hara had had a sexual encounter with a lover in the back row of Grauman's Chinese Theater in Los Angeles. O'Hara vehemently denied it, and she had proof to back up her denials. On the same day that Confidential claimed she was getting busy in Los Angeles, O'Hara's passport showed that she had been in London. Dorothy Dandridge, a singer and actress, also testified. Confidential had published an article called Only the Birds and the Bees Saw What Dorothy Dandridge Did in the Woods,
claiming that Dandridge had had sex with a man in the woods near a resort in Lake Tahoe, Nevada. Now, Dandridge appeared on the stand, stating for the court that what Confidential claimed could never have happened. Dandridge was black, and the man the story alleged she had had sex with was white. During the period in which she had been in Lake Tahoe, Dandridge explained, racial prejudices there had not only precluded her from interacting with white people, but also from walking freely around the resort grounds. She couldn't have even gone into the woods, let alone met a white man there. So Confidential was not infallible. But had they meant to defame the subjects of their articles? Opinions on that varied. One disgruntled former reporter testified that he had wanted to hurt those he wrote about, while others claimed that they were just reporting facts, like any other news publication. The real blame for any damage done, one witness said, lay with the movie studios, who did not enforce the moral clauses in their stars' contracts. Again, it would be up to the jury to decide. In closing arguments, the prosecution doubled down on their themes. They pointed out the familial and financial bonds between Confidential and Hollywood Research. They argued that Confidential had no motive for exposing scandal other than financial gain. They railed against the low morals of the magazine. "Look at them," shouted William Ritzy, pointing his finger at Marjorie and Fred Mead. "They are the self-appointed purveyors of filth and gossip in the United States." For the defense, Crowley fought back. How was Confidential so much different, so much worse than any other publication, he asked. What about girly magazines with their erotic content? Why wasn't the government pursuing them? "Unlike those magazines," Crowley continued, "Confidential is accepted by the community. It is sold over the counter, not under the counter." And then he brought up another point, one that had nearly gotten lost amongst the discussion of celebrities and gossip and smut: the issue of free speech. The prosecution wants to indulge in censorship, to do your thinking for you. "Who is the prosecutor to tell you what you can and can't read?" he asked. "If you find my clients guilty," Crowley told the jury, "you will be taking a precious piece of liberty." Would this plea be enough? After more than a month of testimony and nearly 30 witnesses, the trial ended, and the decision was left in the jury's hands. Soon, it became clear that it would not be a quick deliberation. One day passed, and then another, and then another. The jury returned to the courtroom to ask Judge Walker some clarifying questions. They left again. Things were getting heated amongst the jury. At one point, marshals had to step in. Several jurors had allegedly threatened to throw another juror out of the window. Finally, after a then-record-breaking 14 days of deliberation, the jury returned to the courtroom on October 1st. But they still had no verdict. They were hopelessly stuck, they told Judge Walker, and could not reach a unanimous verdict. Reluctantly, he declared a mistrial. Later, it would emerge that the jurors had voted 7-5 in favor of conviction on the charge of conspiracy to commit criminal libel, and 8-4 on conspiracy to publish obscenity. Now, the government had the option to retry Confidential. But did they want to? Publicly, California Attorney General Pat Brown was quick to declare his desire for a retrial. But privately, he wanted the whole thing to be over and done with, and so did the studios who had first urged him to take the case. The trial had been expensive and exhausting. He wrote to prosecutor Clarence Lynn on October 9th and urged him to settle the case with Confidential. Publicly, Robert Harrison was thrilled by the trial's outcome. He threw a lavish dinner to celebrate Arthur Crowley in New York City and hired a violin player to serenade him. Privately, Harrison was terrified.
The first trial had cost him an estimated $3.5 million in legal fees in today's money. He was worried that another trial would ruin him and perhaps even land his niece Marjorie in jail. So when the prosecutors reached out to discuss a deal, Harrison was receptive. The lawyers got to work hammering out terms. Meanwhile, Pat Brown announced his run for governor. He was elected less than a year later and served two terms. On November 12th, Judge Burton Noble approved a proposed deal between California and Confidential. The terms were simple. The state would drop all charges except the count of conspiracy to publish obscenity. A judge would determine the magazine's guilt on this charge based on the grand jury and trial transcripts. In exchange for the reduced charges, Confidential agreed to stop publishing exposés about celebrities. They also agreed to take out ads publicly announcing this change in editorial direction. In December, Judge Noble found Confidential and her sister magazine, Whisper, guilty of conspiring to publish obscenity. Each magazine was fined $5,000. Where were the studios in all of this? During the trial, now aware that taking the legal route ran the risk of unwelcome exposure, the studios had created another internal anti-scandal magazine committee. Members, including a politically ambitious actor named Ronald Reagan, brainstormed measures to fight Confidential and its cronies. In mid-October, they announced a campaign to root out magazine informants. "We will organize effective opposition to fight these people writers," said one committee member. But their efforts proved unnecessary, because though Confidential had made it through the trial, they had not come out of the battle unscathed. In the spring of 1958, the magazine revealed its new approach to readers. "We're quitting the area of private affairs for the arena of public affairs," read the announcement. "If wiseacres say we've retreated from the bedroom, we'll say yes, that's true. From now on, we'll search the thoroughfares of the globe for stories of public interest." These so-called public interest stories, including gems like "What's Wrong with the Oil Burner in the White House Basement?" and "Penicillin Can Save Your Life," unsurprisingly failed to interest the public at all. Circulation numbers collapsed. After three issues of the new Confidential, Robert Harrison had had enough. He wanted a magazine that drew attention, that started conversations, and most of all, that made money. Under the restrictions placed by the California deal, Confidential could no longer be that magazine. Plus, Harrison was now facing a number of celebrity libel lawsuits. He announced that he was selling the magazine. The new publisher tried to revive interest, but couldn't find an audience. The magazine steadily lost readership and eventually folded. Many people saw Confidential's collapse as a victory for American morality. One newspaper editorial put it like this: "These magazines still may not be fit for most living rooms, but it is generally agreed that they are not quite so bad as they were before. The heavy expenses of the trial appear to have made the publishers and editors of Confidential and her scandalous sisters more conscious of their responsibilities." But other observers were concerned about the potential chilling effects of the trial. The journalist Maurice Solitow expressed these fears. Quote, "Governmental power has been used to alter the editorial content of a national magazine. It has been shown that the cost of defending such a charge is so expensive that by merely threatening an indefinite series of prosecutions, any publication can be put to death. Regardless of one's personal opinion of Confidential, many may regard the use of the judicial power to muzzle a magazine, any magazine, as an act discouraging freedom and controversy." Fortunately, Zolotow's fears were not immediately realized. In the decade after the Confidential trial, the American public and the judicial system seemed to lose their appetite for censorship. Many of the local and state-level literature review boards, which served as de facto censorship organizations, disbanded, usually due to court rulings against them. But censorship has never fully vanished from our landscape. Recently, the country has seen a rise in community efforts to ban or censor books from public and school libraries. The American Library Association reported in September 2023 that the first 8 months of that year contained the highest number of book challenges since it began recording the data in 2003. The number of book challenges had already nearly doubled between 2021 and 2022. Unlike Confidential, which was invested in reinforcing racist, homophobic, and sexist stereotypes, most of the publications being challenged today are those that explore or are supportive of gender, racial, and sexual diversity. But the question at the heart of all these challenges has remained the same: who chooses what the public gets to read? The American Library Association's Deborah Caldwell Stone, in a statement about book challenges, said, quote, "To allow a group of people, or any individual, no matter how powerful or loud, to become the decision maker about what books we can read, or whether libraries exist, is to place all of our rights and liberties in jeopardy." Or, as Arthur Crowley put it in the Confidential trial, "Who is the prosecutor to tell you what you can and can't read?" There are some lighter parallels between Confidential and today, too. Though Confidential itself may not have lasted long, it set the tone for nearly all of the celebrity gossip we consume today. Before Confidential and other scandal magazines like it, Hollywood stars had highly polished images. Confidential revealed the truth behind the glamour. Once the truth was out, there was no going back. And many stars decided that it was better to capitalize on the public's interest in their foibles than try to deny them. In 1964, Robert Harrison was profiled in Esquire magazine and told the reporter, quote, "You couldn't put out a magazine like Confidential again, because movie stars have started writing books about themselves. They tell all. No magazine can compete with that." Many magazines, of course, have tried. From Confidential's ashes rose publications as varied as The National Enquirer and People magazine, as well as online gossip sites like TMZ and television programs like Entertainment Tonight. Robert Harrison, for all his quirks, knew what news sold. And as I sit here now, telling the story of the hidden forces at work behind his magazine's trial, I can't help but think of some of his words. "I sincerely believe the basic vehicle of the story behind the story will be here long after we are all dead." That's the story of California v. Confidential. Stay with me after the break to learn more about the tragic rise and fall of one of the magazine's star writers, who embodied many of the 1950s darkest trends.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or artificial nonsense. It's just pure goodness in every pouch. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. That's Symbiotica.
In the spring of 1953, Robert Harrison was looking for a reporter to write a hit piece about one of his loudest critics, the New York Post editor James Wexler. None of his usual freelancers would do. Harrison wanted to highlight Wexler's youthful membership in the Young Communist League, and thus wanted a noted anti-communist journalist to write the piece. So he reached out to the source of all things anti-communist, the office of Senator Joe McCarthy. 3 years earlier, McCarthy had made national news by declaring that he had a list of hundreds of communists working at the State Department. Since then, he had ruthlessly, and often baselessly, accused hundreds more Americans of communist sympathies, ruining reputations and lives with his hearings in the Senate. One of the main sources of information for these hearings was a prominent anti-communist journalist named Howard Rushmore, who now worked for McCarthy. When Robert Harrison called McCarthy's office in the spring of 1953, it was with Rushmore that he wished to be connected. Rushmore had not always been an anti-communist. In fact, he had once been a passionate communist. Born on July 2, 1912, in Sheridan, Wyoming, Rushmore grew up in profound poverty. As a young reporter in Missouri, he had been radicalized by witnessing both terrible working conditions and the lynching of a young black man. Rushmore was desperate for a better world and admired the conviction with which communist organizations railed against injustice. By the 1930s, he was prominent in the communist movement and served as film critic for the major communist newspaper, The Daily Worker. But in 1939, Rushmore had a catastrophic falling out with the Communist Party over his positive review of the film Gone with the Wind. Other Daily Worker employees accused him of being racist and of sympathizing with the Confederacy. Outraged, Rushmore left both the paper and the party and decided to devote himself to destroying communism in America. His rise in the anti-communist movement was just as swift as it had been in the communist movement. He was hired by the right-wing Journal American newspaper and became the country's first full-time reporter on the communist movement. By the 1940s, with his anti-communist expertise established, Rushmore became a popular witness for government investigations. He was a key witness in the House Un-American Activities Committee's hearings on communism in Hollywood. In 1953, Senator McCarthy made Rushmore his research director. His power seemed limitless. But under the surface, cracks were appearing. Rushmore was an alcoholic with violent tendencies. He had a prickly personality, a combative nature, and a condescending manner. He also had a tendency to fabricate evidence. Once, he had claimed to have an FBI report showing that 150 government employees in Washington State were Soviet spies. When the FBI asked him to produce this report, he gave them a letter he himself had written. And he would eventually lose his job with McCarthy after it was revealed that he was using private testimony from the Senate hearings for his articles in the Journal American. After agreeing to write that first article for Confidential on Wexler, Rushmore had contributed occasionally to the magazine, writing mainly anti-communist exposés like The Strange Death of J. Robert Oppenheimer's Red Sweetheart. Rushmore thought the tabloid business was beneath him. But when the Journal American fired him in 1954, over personality and pay disputes, he came to Confidential full-time. Eventually, Rushmore became Confidential's chief editor. His main passion was exposés of stars for communist leanings or homosexuality. But he chafed against Harrison's requirements that he also report on what Rushmore saw as less consequential celebrity gossip. In turn, Harrison was annoyed by Rushmore's obsessive focus on politics. By 1955, the two men had fallen out, and Rushmore left the magazine that September, under less than amicable terms, though Confidential gave him severance pay and promised to assume liability for any libel suits on articles published under his watch. As he had done with the Communist Party, Rushmore became determined to destroy the organization he felt spurned by. He took his severance pay and bought a plane ticket to California, where he met up with an attorney who was representing several celebrities in suits against the magazine. He would eventually testify at Pat Brown's grand jury hearings, where his testimony that, quote, "some of the stories are true and some have nothing to back them up at all," would go a long way towards convincing the grand jury to bring an indictment against Confidential. At the trial, Rushmore testified for the prosecution, continuing his assault on the magazine. When Arthur Crowley pressed Rushmore on cross about his goals in writing for Confidential, asking, "Did you have the specific intention yourself to injure someone?" the lawyer clearly expected a no, but Rushmore shocked Crowley in the courtroom by replying, "I certainly did." Though Rushmore seemingly got what he wanted with the destruction of Confidential, the trial also ruined him. This was the second time he had publicly turned against an organization that had employed him, and no one could trust him anymore. Theo Wilson, who reported on the trial for the New York Daily News, called Rushmore, quote, "a professional turncoat on the skids." He was unemployable, unlikable, and sinking ever deeper into the bottle. When prosecutor Clarence Lynn approached Rushmore in the fall of 1957 about testifying in a potential Confidential retrial, he found a broken man. "He told me," Lynn said, "that he thought he had been ruined by his activities in the Confidential trial." Much of Rushmore's anger ended up being channeled against his wife, Frances, who he physically abused. On January 3, 1958, the worst happened. Rushmore killed Frances and then himself in a taxi in New York City. Robert Harrison received the news in another taxi. On his way home from the airport, the driver asked him if he'd heard the news that the publisher of Confidential had just shot himself. Harrison, who was actually the publisher of Confidential, was baffled. Howard Rushmore's story is a sad and sordid one, but his journey also tells us so much about the country he lived in. As a young man, he witnessed terrible things and hoped for a better world. When he could not achieve that, he set out to watch the world burn. He rode the progressive wave of the 1930s, rallied behind nationalist causes in the 1940s, and played on fears during the Red Scare in the 1950s. He recognized the country's interest in celebrities, and he made money off of it, but it sickened him too. He was a mess of contradictions, a difficult man. And despite his protests that Confidential was beneath him, there is probably no better avatar for the magazine's potent brand of scandal. Thank you for listening to History on Trial. The main sources for this episode were Samantha Barbas's book, Confidential, Confidential, The Inside Story of Hollywood's Notorious Scandal Magazine, and Henry E. Scott's book, Shocking True Story, The Rise and Fall of Confidential, America's Most Scandalous Scandal Magazine. For a full bibliography, as well as a transcript of this episode with citations, please visit historyontrialpodcast.com. History on Trial is written and hosted by me, Mira Hayward. The show is edited and produced by Jesse Funk, with supervising producer Trevor Young and executive producers Dana Schwartz, Alexander Williams, Matt Frederick, and Mira Hayward. Learn more about the show at historyontrialpodcast.com and follow us on Instagram at historyontrial and on Twitter at _historyontrial. Find more podcasts from iHeartRadio by visiting the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity, designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. Gainbridge is helping build a better financial future for women. Retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
With the best all-inclusive vacation deals to Mexico and the Caribbean, booking your getaway with Cheap Caribbean Vacations means you have more freedom to do your deal. Whether you want to enjoy snorkeling, endless margaritas and more, or simply soak up the sun and sand in a tropical paradise, Cheap Caribbean Vacations has your deal for that. Plan and book the exact getaway you want at exactly the right price for you by using our exclusive budget beach finder, or find a featured all-inclusive package to Ocean by H10 Hotels and do your deal at CheapCaribbean.com.